At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Over the last 7 episodes, we've studied the life and times of Lyndon Baines Johnson, the man who would ascend from the vice presidency to become the 36th chief executive of the United States when President John F. Kennedy was murdered in broad daylight on November 22, 1963. I had previously said that this would be our final episode of the LBJ series, but to get all of the information in and provide a meaningful conclusion, we're going to need a 9th installment on Lyndon Johnson, which will be out next week. In this 8th episode of the series, we continue our analysis of Lyndon Johnson by looking at his order to his pilots to fly his plane in bad weather, the likelihood, had JFK lived, that Johnson would have been removed from the 1964 presidential ticket, Madeleine Brown's claim about the alleged party at the Murchison home the night before the assassination, and Barr McClellan's assertion that Johnson's attorney, Ed Clark, was a central figure in planning the assassination.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. On February 17, 1961, about a month after being sworn in as vice president, Lyndon Johnson called for his airplane pilots to pick him up at his ranch in the Texas Hill Country along the Pedernales River. The pilots had stayed overnight in Austin the previous day. Pilot Harold Teague told Johnson that it would be extremely dangerous to fly because of the weather and because there were no ground control instruments on the landing strip at the Johnson Ranch. According to author James Evetts Haley, Johnson is said to have, quote, exploded, venting his profanity upon the pilot, demanding to know, "What do you think I'm paying you for?" and telling Teague to, quote, "Get that plane to the ranch." According to Barr McClellan, who we'll get to later in this episode, Johnson's urgency was because he had to visit with Billy Sol Estes in person regarding Henry Marshall's ongoing investigation. The timeline would fit, but I couldn't find any independent corroboration for that idea. Teague, the pilot, called his wife before the flight and told her that he had been ordered to make the flight. Despite the bad weather, the pilots followed Johnson's orders. But when they searched for the runway through the fog, they couldn't see it, and there was no technology on the ground to help them find it. Johnson's 2 pilots were killed instantly when the plane crashed into a rocky hillside about 7 miles from the vice president's ranch. Johnson told the Rocky Mountain News, quote, "I've lost the best pilot in the world and 2 wonderful friends. If they'd been 30 feet higher, they would have missed the hill." Even with the tragedy that was caused by Johnson's selfish disregard for aviation safety, Johnson still found a way to blame the incident on the pilots. Between the Billy Sol Estes scandal, the Bobby Baker scandal, the Don Reynolds testimony, and the general acrimony between Johnson and the Kennedys, an important historical question is, if President Kennedy had lived, would Johnson have been invited to run on the 1964 ticket, or would he have been replaced? An October 29th, 1963 Newsday article on the Bobby Baker scandal said that the Justice Department started the investigation to embarrass Johnson so that he would not be on the 1964 ticket, according to unnamed sources. In a press conference 2 days later, President Kennedy was asked whether he wanted Johnson on the ticket and whether he expected that Johnson would be on the ticket. Kennedy responded, quote, "Yes, to both of those questions. That is correct." So the last time President Kennedy spoke about the issue in public, he said that Johnson would be on the ticket. However, the president's public statement did not accurately reflect what was going on behind the scenes. You may recall that when Bobby Baker was being investigated by the Senate in the fall of 1963, it was Attorney General Robert Kennedy who was providing information about Baker to Senator John Williams, who was leading the investigation. RFK was so invested in bringing Johnson down that he assigned a Justice Department lawyer to supply the committee with information about Johnson and Baker's financial dealings. Burkett Van Kirk was the chief counsel for the Republicans on the Senate Rules Committee during these investigations. Van Kirk told author Seymour Hersh that Bobby Kennedy's motive in providing this information to the Republicans was, quote, "To get rid of Johnson, to dump him. I am as sure of that as I am that the sun comes up in the east." There's no doubt that Reynolds' testimony would have gotten Johnson out of the vice presidency. Colonel Howard Burris, who was Johnson's military aide, told historian John Newman that Lyndon Johnson knew he was going to be thrown off of the ticket. Evelyn Lincoln, President Kennedy's personal secretary, said that the president discussed the Bobby Baker investigation with her and told her that Lyndon Johnson would not be his running mate. This conversation was just 2 days before the president left Washington for his 1963 Texas trip. Similarly, President Kennedy mentioned that he was leaning towards not keeping Johnson on the ticket to North Carolina Governor Terry Sanford. Hubert Humphrey also said that he heard Bobby Kennedy was plotting Johnson's ouster from the 1964 ticket. On November 22nd, the Dallas Morning News ran an article with the title, "Nixon Predicts Kennedy May Drop Johnson." On the other hand, Bobby Kennedy said during his oral history interviews that there was no plan to drop Johnson. It should be noted, however, that those statements were made while Johnson was the sitting president and when Bobby still had political ambitions of his own. So, while it remains a somewhat disputed issue, we can safely say that public statements were to the effect that LBJ would not be dropped. Behind closed doors, those in the know were of the opinion that Johnson would not have remained on the 1964 presidential ticket if John F. Kennedy had survived Dallas. We can't say that we've fully covered the JFK assassination-related allegations against Lyndon Johnson without discussing Johnson's alleged mistress, Madeline Brown. On November 5th, 1982, during a meeting of the Dallas Press Club, Brown stood up and announced to the room that she had an extramarital relationship with Lyndon Johnson from 1948 until 1967. She claimed to have caught Johnson's eye at a 1948 party associated with his radio station, KTBC, and says that the next time she saw Johnson their affair began. In addition to her affair with Johnson, Brown is most known for the claims she made about Johnson related to the JFK assassination. Here's Madeline Brown in the documentary series, The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
Early the next morning, only a few hours before the assassination, Madeline received a phone call from Johnson, who was back in Fort Worth with Kennedy.
Lyndon called me from the Texas Hotel, and he was still irate. I said, Lyndon, about last night, and he went to cursing. He used foul language all the time, and he said, those Kennedys, he repeated, they will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. And I'd like the entire world to know how I personally feel is the fact Lyndon Johnson knew about the assassination and was a part of it. I met Lyndon on New Year's Eve at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin. And the people in Dallas, I mean, everyone was talking about Lyndon Johnson was the cause of the assassination, and it made my heart very heavy. I just couldn't believe that he could be a part of something so bad. So I confronted Lyndon. I said, Lyndon, you've got to tell me, were you part of the assassination? And of course, he had a high temper fit, hit the wall, and he was very irate and angry. And he said, no, I was not, but the oil people, or he called them the fat cats of Texas that I knew, and the intelligence was the cause of the assassination. I am sure Lyndon did not make the plans per se, but he had the key people that he could call to actually do it.
So Madeline Brown says that she had an affair with Johnson and that he admitted that the assassination was not done by a lone nut, but was instead a plot between Texas fat cats and intelligence. In addition to Brown's claim that Johnson told her there was a conspiracy, Madeline Brown is perhaps best known for her story about a party at Clint Murchison's house on the night before the assassination with a very impressive guest list. Here's a clip of Brown talking about the Murchison party from The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
We had H.L. Hunt, Murchison, Lyndon Johnson made an appearance. We had Hoover. We had Richard Nixon. They were the most influential people there. But I was under the impression that since J. Edgar Hoover was there, that it was to honor Hoover rather than anything else. When Lyndon came in, no one was expecting him. So when Lyndon arrived at Clint Murchison's, they all went into a conference room. And you could just feel the atmosphere. And when Lyndon came out, I was, of course, happy to see him. I did not know that he was going to be there. And he whispered in my ear at that time, those blank-de-blank Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. So he departed. The party rapidly broke up after Lyndon departed.
This is a huge claim that Brown is making. She's saying that the night before the assassination, Lyndon Johnson met with Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover, along with Texas oil tycoons like H.L. Hunt and Clint Murchison, and that during that party, there was a private meeting which appeared to be about the assassination because Johnson came out of the meeting saying that the Kennedys would never embarrass him again. Brown is not alone in asserting that there was a party with big-name VIPs that happened the night before the assassination. A woman named Mae Newman, who worked in another house for Virginia Murchison, Clint Sr.'s second wife, also supports Madeline Brown's claim. Here's what Mae Newman had to say in The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
I remember, well, the night before the assassination. I worked with a man called Jewel Pfeiffer, black man, which was Virginia Murchison's chauffeur. He got a call from her stepson, John, at the big house. They were having a big party for a very special guest that was coming from Washington to go to the party, by the name of Bulldog, which I found out later was J. Edgar Hoover. And he said he was very excited about doing this, going on this trip out to the airport to take this special guest to a very special party, big party. And I asked him when he came back if he got a good tip, and he said no, and he was very, very upset. He had to go back that night to take J. Edgar Hoover to the airport to go back to Washington. And he still didn't get a tip.
Further verification of Hoover's presence in Dallas on the eve of the assassination came from a friend of May's who worked at the Murchison family home.
Beulah May Holman, she was the cook at John and Loopy's house, and she wanted me to go help her that night, which I didn't, but I knew she told me she was cooking quail, and I wanted the recipe, so she gave it to me. She said that it was a very important guest by the name of J. Edgar Hoover that was coming, and I should go out and help her so I could get to meet him. If it was a film star, I probably would have gone, but I didn't know who he was. No, not at that time.
I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching in the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick 5-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. They found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. Best of all, not only is every product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you can get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches the mood you're looking for. 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. So Mae Newman claims that two other people told her about the party, and specifically, the fact that J. Edgar Hoover was attending. There's the chauffeur, Jule Pfeiffer, who said that he went to pick up Hoover at the airport and then he took him back later that night and that he didn't get a tip either time. Then there's Beulah May Holman, the cook who also said that Hoover was coming to the party. Wearing my lawyer hat, the first thing that comes to mind is that Mae Newman did not have personal knowledge of either of these purported facts. She merely relayed what other people told her, and we have no other corroboration for those two stories. Still, standing alone, the fact that Newman says this does tend to support the existence of an Assassination Eve party that was attended by J. Edgar Hoover. On the other hand, there are several counterpoints to Madeline Brown and Mae Newman's claims. First, there seems to be confusion about where exactly the party happened. For Mae Newman's story to make sense, the party must have been held at John Murchison's house, not Clint Murchison Sr.'s house. Beulah May Holman, who told May Newman about the dinner party for Hoover, was a cook for John Murchison and his wife Lupe at their house. Clint Murchison Sr.'s closest home to Dallas was in Glad Oaks, Texas, just south of Athens, Texas. Let's take a look at what we know when it comes to the whereabouts of each of these men on the evening of November 21st, 1963. First, Clint Murchison Sr. was at his home at Glad Oaks the night before the assassination, and there was no party, according to Eulah Tilley, who was a cook for Murchison Sr. at the time. Another person who Brown says was at the Murchison party was H.L. Hunt, but Hunt's assistant, John Currington, says that he was not present. If Hunt would have attended such a party, Currington says that he would have been Hunt's driver. And Currington definitively states that there was no such party that was attended by H.L. Hunt on the night before the assassination. As for Richard Nixon, it is true that he was in Dallas on the night before the assassination. After Nixon lost the 1962 election for California governor, he went to work as a corporate lawyer, and Pepsi, one of his clients, was having its annual bottlers convention in Dallas that week. Tony Zappi and Don Safran, Dallas Morning News entertainment reporters, claimed that they saw Nixon at the Empire Room at the Statler Hilton Hotel on the Thursday night before the assassination. Nixon was sitting with actress Joan Crawford. Entertainer Robert Clary of Hogan's Heroes stopped the show to point out Richard Nixon's presence. The news reporters left around 10:45 p.m., and when they did, Nixon was still there. As for Lyndon Johnson, he was in Houston on Thursday night, and his flight into Fort Worth landed at 11:07 p.m. The motorcade from the airport arrived at the Hotel Texas at 11:50. There's a photograph of Johnson entering the hotel just after the motorcade's arrival. If the party was at Clint Murchison Sr.'s home, which is not possible according to the cook, Eulah Tilley, Lyndon Johnson would have had to drive 2 hours, which means that he would have arrived around 2 a.m. in Glad Oaks. If the party was at John and Lupe Murchison's home on Ash Bluff Lane in Dallas, Johnson would have arrived around 1 a.m. at the earliest. However, that would assume that Johnson left immediately after the photo was taken at the Fort Worth Hotel. One thing that sticks out to me is that Madeline Brown says that she was already at the party when Johnson arrived and that she was surprised to see him there. Are we to believe that Madeline Brown was invited to a party at the Murchison home or ranch, whatever it was, without Lyndon Johnson? For me, it doesn't make a lot of sense that Johnson's mistress would be invited to an important party alone without Johnson. The Murchison party was first reported by early JFK assassination researcher Penn Jones Jr. in his book Forgive My Grief, Volume 3. Jones claims that both Nixon and Hoover were present at Clint Murchison Sr.'s home, but Jones doesn't mention any other attendees. In his book, Jones ends the section on the Murchison party with, quote, "Admittedly, our information about Hoover's presence was learned secondhand, but it is reliable. We will never tell how we got the information." In the same section of Jones' book where he mentions the assassination party, he talks about an article written by Val M. of the Dallas Times-Herald about a party that happened in 1969 thrown by Clint Murchison Jr.'s wife. Madeline Brown would later state that that same journalist, Val M., wrote a story about the Murchison party the night before the assassination. But when Brown asked M. to find the story, she said it didn't exist. It could be a coincidence, but Madeline Brown mentioning Val M.'s story seems to be proof that she was at least aware of Penn Jones' book and that she misunderstood the timeline of the Val M. story. Given what we just covered about the original reporting of Penn Jones, combined with the fact that Hunt, Nixon, and Clint Murchison Sr. all had alibis, and Johnson would not have arrived until 1 a.m. to the party at the extreme earliest, it seems clear to me that the most likely scenario is that Madeline Brown made this party up. Now, we do have the word of May Newman, and that's worth something. Newman never saw anything with her own eyes. Instead, she spoke to the chauffeur and the chef at John Murchison's home. The burden of proof for a big claim like this is on the party that's asserting the claim. Aside from Newman and whoever Penn Jones' anonymous source was, there's no independent corroboration for the Murchison party. Separate from the issue of whether the Murchison party actually happened is the question of whether Brown had a child that was fathered by Lyndon Johnson. Author Joan Mellon believed that Johnson was the father of Brown's son, Stephen Mark Brown. I've got to be honest, if you look at pictures of Stephen Brown, there is a resemblance to Lyndon Johnson, but that's no guarantee that he was Johnson's son. Stephen Mark Brown filed a paternity lawsuit against the Johnson estate for $10.5 million in 1987. The case was dismissed after Brown failed to appear at a court hearing. The next year, Stephen Brown died of cancer at age 39. The only evidence that Madeline Brown had any sort of relationship with Lyndon Johnson is a photo of Brown and Johnson seated at a dinner party with her back to Johnson. While I believe it's possible that Brown had an affair with Johnson, and it's even possible that Stephen Mark Brown was Lyndon Johnson's son, the failure to follow through on the litigation to prove this disputed fact is a real red flag. Having covered Madeline Brown, we must also address the claims of another Texan who says that he had inside information about LBJ killing President Kennedy. Barr McClellan was an attorney at the Clark, Thomas, and Winters law firm from 1966 until 1977. The firm was named for Ed Clark, Lyndon Johnson's personal attorney, the same one who bailed Mack Wallace out of jail in 1951 and would go on to be ambassador to Australia. In 2003, McClellan wrote a book called Blood, Money, and Power, in which he shared what he had been told about the JFK assassination by senior partner Don Thomas. As an associate attorney at the law firm, McClellan was involved in drafting a research memo about whether Lyndon Johnson's physician was subject to the attorney-client privilege, which McClellan said was done to make sure that LBJ's post-presidential psychiatry confessions could not be disclosed. The primary first-hand information that McClellan has to share is that Don Thomas told him, quote, "Clark handled all of that in Dallas." Years later, another partner at the firm, John Coates, told McClellan, quote, "If the truth be told, Clark arranged the assassination of Kennedy." While these statements from partners at a firm that was Lyndon Johnson's law firm are disturbing and potentially point to Johnson's involvement in the assassination, the challenge with McClellan's book is that much of it is the author's speculation about what he believes must have happened without any evidentiary support. McClellan also relies heavily on the sixth floor Mack Wallace fingerprint, which we can no longer say is credible based on the work of Bob Garrett. Next time on Solving JFK, we conclude our series on Lyndon Johnson with part 9. Was Lyndon Johnson just an innocent bystander who benefited from the actions of a lone nut? Or was he an active participant in a plot to kill President Kennedy? If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.